Hey everybody, it's Charlie here. Happy Christmas, Merry New Year. This is our holiday rerun, except it's not. This is more of a special Lost in the Stacks. We're going to play for you the audio from a live interview that Amit recorded with Professor J. Mark Souther on the occasion of his presentation to the campus, Mobilizing History, Reflections on a Decade of Digital Humanities Practice on Two Continents. So the way this happened was Professor Souther was visiting us from Cleveland, where he is a professor of history and the director of the Center for Public History and Digital Humanities at Cleveland State University. He was giving a presentation about his work, and we convinced him to do this hybrid presentation. He gave a shortened version of the standard presentation that he would have done, and then we interpolated it with a kind of faux Lost in the Stacks episode. Amit did the interview, and I hid out in the back with a couple computers and a mixing board and a soundboard, and I fired clips and music at them while they recorded the interview. The presentation is in SmartTech, which is our digital repository here at Georgia Tech. I'm going to give you a couple links now, and then I'll give them to you again at the end of the show. You can find Mobilizing History, Reflections on a Decade of Digital Humanities Practice on Two Continents if you go to SmartTech, SmartTech, gatech.edu. You can search by the name, or you can go straight to hdl.handle.net/1853/60984. See the whole thing, including the live footage from this interview. There's also a transcript available on that site. All right, here we go. Here is the audio from the second piece of Mobilizing History by J. Mark Souther with Amit Doshi and our attempt at a public participation presentation style. Hope you dig it.
Are listening to Lost in the Stacks, and this special episode is called Mobilizing History with Professor J. Mark Souther. I'm Amit Doshi, joined by my library colleague and co-host on the board, Charlie Bennett, and we're really thrilled to welcome Professor Souther to campus and to the Georgia Tech Library. So Mark, thank you for setting the table with your presentation. This format allows us to make your project come alive by bringing in sound from your projects in Cleveland and hearing you describe both the context and the process for collecting these oral histories in more detailed personal terms. So with that, let's begin with a clip.
Two Cadillacs drove up, black Cadillacs drove up. When a Cadillac came through your neighborhood, it was like everybody stopped to look. Who has a Cadillac? Or who died? It's gotta be a funeral. And we only knew Cadillacs to be black or white. Okay, so so these two Cadillacs drove up in front of Scatters. We just sitting in the wagon, like, look at them Cadillacs. Wow, they're pretty, you know. And, you know, just, and then these guys got out of the car. I can't tell you how many. These white guys got out of the car. They walked into his restaurant. And next door to his restaurant was a cigarette machine company, distributor company that he had. And jukebox, I don't know if it was jukebox, but he had cigarette machines where he distributed machines and made money off cigarettes, right? So we heard this pop, 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 shots. But we didn't know they were shots because we just out there. We didn't hear shots. We didn't hear shots in the neighborhood. It didn't happen in our neighborhood, so we didn't know what they were. And these guys nonchalantly came out of the restaurant, got in their Cadillacs, and just drove up towards Brattonall. Drove north on 105th, nice, and not like sped off, just drove away. And we said, no, wow, this is a nice car. I said, okay. Then minute later or so, you saw Scatters come staggering out of the restaurant. We thought, see, back in the day, back then, men drank a lot of booze. And it was nothing to see a man drunk staggering down the street any time of day. You're just a drunk man going home, you know. And we saw Scatters staggering out of the restaurant. We figured he was just drunk. He was shot, but we didn't know it. He staggered from his restaurant right next door to his cigarette distributing place right next door, and he fell dead.
So tell us about what we just heard. Who was Scatter?
Scatter was the nickname for a man named Herbin Stevens. He went by Scatter after a while. He was a native of Alabama, Birmingham. Came up to Cleveland in 1934 with his family. He was a young man at the time, and you know, about 14 or 15 years old. When he got a little older, he got into boxing. He became quite a noted boxer, and knew Sugar Ray Robinson and a lot of the big names in boxing at the time. And Stevens also, by the 1950s, operated a restaurant. And as was mentioned in the clip, it became known as Scatter's Barbecue. Sometimes Scatter's Red Hot Barbecue or Flame Barbecue. It had various names, but always was Scatter's because of his nickname. And so Stevens, ended up having this whole little block, a little strip along East 105th Street in the Glenville neighborhood of Cleveland, where this restaurant and his cigarette vending service was located. And so I think what this clip does, to me, it does a couple of things. For one thing, it situates him in place and time. We get a feel for him. He was a flamboyant personality, and a little bit of that comes through, this idea of, all the Cadillacs at his funeral. There were actually 63 Cadillac Eldorados, and there were 3,000 people who came to his funeral. So he was quite a figure in Cleveland. I think it also complicates assumptions that many people have about places in the city. Glenville, to give you just a quick idea, it's on Cleveland's east side. It transitioned to predominantly African-American by the 1950s, although it had an earlier history of black presence there. But by the time he opened his business, it was largely an African-American neighborhood. And in the late 1960s, the Glenville shootout was one of a couple of so-called riots on Cleveland's east side that were part of the sort of the long hot summers of the late 60s. This one involved black nationalists clashing with police. And so the idea that here it is 1967, and the idea is this man doesn't expect to hear gunshots. But I think that for our 2019 ears, or many people's at least, the assumption would be that, well, Glenville is maybe not the safest place, and maybe there it's a place where you might expect to hear gunshots. And maybe you expected to hear them in the late 60s because, hey, this is where the Glenville shootout occurred. So it challenges people's easy, quick assumptions and gets them to think a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an evocative tone to that clip, and I think we'll hear more clips where you really get it does challenge assumptions for sure. How do you understand... Well, first of all, there are two terms here that I think it would be helpful to clarify, because I'm not a practitioner, but place-based history and public history, are they the same thing, or is there a nuance there?
I would say there's definitely a nuance there. There is if you picture a Venn diagram, some public history, a lot of public history is place-based or focused. A lot of place-based history is aimed toward the public, but they need not... do more than just overlap partially. So let me take public history briefly and give maybe a quick definition that I sometimes give. Public history is history as it's presented to the public, but also it's history done not just for the public, but often with the public. So it challenges the idea that it's scholars on one side and the broad community on the other. Both actually have a lot to bring to the table. And so to borrow a term of an oral historian, Michael Frisch, it's a shared authority. So we give up our sole authority as knowledge possessors, as scholars, and recognize that while other people may not have the training we have and the expertise, they also bring their own form of knowledge, and we can meet somewhere in a common space and work together to the benefit of both. Now, place-based history, as you'd expect, a lot of public history is done in places like, museums, historic sites. You think of house museums or national parks. And yeah, those are very place-based. But not all public history is explicitly place-based. So I think of place-based history as one that begins with the idea that the physicality of the place matters. It's a place not just where you can connect sensory experiences and and memories that attach to place, but it's also a place that people can value and that matters, that sometimes changes the trajectory of history, because things happen in a certain place in a certain way that may be different from other places, and we can compare those and analyze them. So I think it functions on various levels, ranging from the analytical to the sensory, and adds quite a lot.
Well, that's a great overview, and I feel much more educated about the difference here. Let's move on to another clip that describes the entertainment at Cleveland's largest African-American-owned hotel.
Like I said, you listen to the radio. What are you listening to? Temptations, Mary Wells, Marvelettes. You're listening to them every day. So if you're a promoter, and you can get all of those people together, you start saying, well, how much is going to cost me? And that during that, they wasn't really charging a lot of money then, because reviews, everybody rode the bus. Everybody was on the same bus. Sometimes you didn't even stay in a hotel, just travel. And if you did, they had certain hotels you stayed at, like I said, the Majestic, what is it, $2 a night, $3 a night, or something like that. Yeah, really. The Teresa Hotel up in New York. So the traveling expenses weren't that bad because, number one, you couldn't stay in any of the white hotels. You couldn't stay in those places where they would charge you that kind of money. So you only stay in certain places you could stay. So they could afford to bring in, even Gleason sometime would have maybe somebody like Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell and maybe Mary Wells, not the whole nine yards, but maybe two or three different acts. They could afford it then because the expense, the overhead, like I said, wasn't that much, because that's before they started bringing the whole show. Like Motown started bringing the whole review. They had a big band, an orchestra. So I think it was Popcorn and the Mohawks. And then they had the Funk Brothers. And then that's when the money started going up and up and up and up and up and up. It changed.
So that's a wonderful clip. I love all of that, all those bands, all that music. And there's a reference to certain hotels, such as the Majestic, that black performers would stay in. And it sounds like an allusion, and we see a slide here, to the Green Book. And I wonder if you could talk, because I think this has entered the popular media now, this notion of the Green Book. You want to talk a little bit about that guide?
Sure. The Green Book was a guide that was published by a man named Victor Hugo Green. He was a postal worker in Harlem, New York. And he saw that, everywhere African-Americans went, they and not just in the South, the Jim Crow South, where there were segregation laws on the books in the 1930s. But he also saw the same sorts of discrimination, maybe by custom, if not by law, in northern cities and in western cities. So what he wanted to do is to create a guide that would facilitate pleasure travel by African-Americans by helping them navigate the challenges that face them on a day-to-day basis on the road, whether it be what gas stations would serve them. This is in the day when we're talking about full-service gas stations. It's not just go pump your own gas and go. So where would you get service as an African-American? Where would you find public accommodations such as hotels or restaurants or tourist homes that would accept you and serve you without at least infringing on your dignity, and at most saying no, you can't be served at all. So that's what he wanted to do. And so from 1936 to 1966, he published this annual guide called the Green Book. It started out as the Negro Motorist's Green Book, and then it evolved into the Negro Traveler's Green Book. And of course, as you'd imagine, at the tail end of that time, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 begins to really open up where it hadn't already begun to happen. It really opened up more opportunities for African Americans to travel to places that previously wouldn't accept them. The Majestic Hotel in Cleveland was a place that was featured every year in this guide. And I think what the voice you heard, by the way, was George Hendricks, who's a pretty big R&B singer and has been for a long time in Cleveland. And so he's reflecting on a time that really transitioned across the 60s, of course, the Motown era, largely in the 60s, when African-Americans might not have been flat-out rejected at a white-owned hotel, but they would have found discrimination. It would have been not only more comfortable, but as he also says, more affordable to stay in a place like the Majestic. And then he did.
How do you, because it seems like there's so many stories you could tell, whether it's in Kisumu or Cleveland, how do you prioritize what stories to tell? Because it seems like you're making some serious decisions there.
Yeah, I'll tell you that when we started back in the early to mid-2000s, we were doing project-driven oral history collecting. So we were starting with the Euclid Corridor project, and then it evolved into Cleveland Historical. And initially, we were thinking about places, and we wanted to have someone reminiscing about or adding their own experiences and descriptions of these places. And so it started out searching for people who could tell a story about a place that we already were writing about. As time went on, we realized we're developing an archive. So we started looking at very carefully how to properly archive and then share these publicly, the full interviews. And the collecting, the rationale for collecting began to evolve. And so it started to be more about where did we find interest in the community for telling people's stories, whether it was an organization or a neighborhood. And we started collecting in more focused ways. And I've tried to make it a priority to expand the range of voices that are heard so that we're not just hearing, the same narrow range of people. We try to work in more underserved communities increasingly. One of our faculty at CSU is working in the Arab community in Cleveland and has been doing interviews with Arab Americans. And in the last few years, I've had students working on the particular neighborhoods that are predominantly African American and tried to do things like documenting black suburbanization on Cleveland's east side. So we've tried to focus in on certain things like that and then let those drive the project rather than let the project drive the oral history.
Yeah, so let's dig into that a little bit deeper, because in your earlier remarks, you referred to this work as a living laboratory or a learning laboratory. And in what ways, like, what are the impacts, what are the kinds of feedback that you get from students, whether they're undergraduate students? Are they all history majors, or are some enticed for other reasons?
Well, I think in terms of to answer the question about the part about students and what they come in expecting and where they're from. Most of my students, it depends on the level, even in an upper level course, and I should say that that's where I do use Cleveland Historical and the oral histories more. Sometimes I use them in class in an illustrative way. In a survey course, more sparingly though, because you have to cover so much ground and you really can't get into oral history clips for very long. But for upper level courses such as Introduction to Public History or U.S. Urban History, it's an opportunity for not just history majors, but often for students who come from other disciplines to come in, and even though they may not go on to study history, they are able to gain certain skills. And I think I won't lie, I mean, some people certainly come in and they find out they have to do the work and they drop the course. When they see my syllabus, some of them just half faint and they don't show up the next class. But those who stay, I think, are intrigued by the idea that they're going to do something that has portable skills. They're gaining digital skills, they're gaining critical thinking, and written expression skills that they can actually use in a variety of areas. And so for me, what this project does in short is it serves two functions. I mean, one is the illustrative. I can use some of these really rich oral histories to illustrate something like segregation in the urban north, for instance. I could also, on the other hand, use it to help students do the kinds of things, develop the kinds of skills that I mentioned, and also to bend their writing toward a different audience. So it's a very different thing, you know, to write an academic paper that the professor reads and grades and files away, than it is to think about how do I make this engaging for a public audience? How do I repackage it, if you will?
Yeah, I imagine that it creates perhaps a sense of empathy, particularly among students that may not have actively engaged with this material. It may have been more of a passive kind of engagement. So let's transition to a clip that I think perhaps illustrates some of the more powerful experiences that students might have with this material.
Skateland was, the city was actually segregated at that time. I don't think, well, they didn't put up signs black and white, but you just knew that black folks didn't go to Skateland. White folks didn't come to play more. And that's basically what it entailed. In fact, you know, as a kid going to play more, I didn't think white folks could skate until I went to Skateland. And with, you know, about this time they had integrated, and I found out that white boys could skate a little bit, you know. And that's, you know, a lot of things were, I guess, just you knew that, hey, this is some place that you don't go. And, you know, we were all fine with it. And that's basically what it is. I don't think it was a good thing, but, you know, at that time it was a status quo, and that's, you know, you just dealt with it.
Yeah, that phrase, you just knew. I feel like you could have an entire class just on that phrase. So this work seems very innovative and progressive to me, two words that I often hear in faculty meetings. But I'm curious how this relates to just the formal activities of a history professor. Does this count as research and scholarship? If not, what does it count as? And if it does, is it as important as publishing in a peer-reviewed journal? Or I'm just curious about how this fits in.
That's a great question, and I think we could have a whole discussion about this one issue. It's a very timely issue, and I'll say that the American Historical Association, or AHA, has done a lot of great work in recent years trying to help departments in schools and colleges figure this out. How do you measure digital humanities scholarship, and is it the same? Is there an equivalent to traditional publishing, for example? Should we even be asking those questions? Should we instead be judging it on its own digital terms? It's it's a different format. It may have different products and different processes that in themselves need to be evaluated in a different way. So I think to answer your question, I think that there's not a simple metric that we can apply. We can't just say, for example, that, okay, maybe at a given university, one peer-reviewed book or whatever it is, six peer-reviewed journal articles in the humanities gets you tenure, or the second set of that maybe gets you to full professor with maybe some other things such as national reputation and so on. But to me, digital humanities projects are so widely varying that they come in so many sizes and types that it can be very difficult, even for digital humanists, to make their case for starters. But more importantly, I think it's digital humanists have a case to make and are, I think, making it. I think it's for those who maybe are not as versed in this to do a lot of listening and a lot of asking questions and investigating. I think for one one thing, research is very central at all stages of a project. You could certainly say that anything from deciding what platform to use, thinking about, you know, conceptualizing the project, creating partnerships and collaborations, preparing and analyzing data, connecting all of that to your content expertise, trying to extend scholarship to broader audiences, and then engaging with those audiences. All those are things that maybe you could argue are not easily measured, but I would argue that we should take the time to try to measure those in some way. We shouldn't ask digital scholars to simply translate what they've done into a peer-reviewed journal article before we're willing to engage with it and to say, okay, this meets our stamp of approval. One of the key problems is, how do you deal with projects that may not have a finish line? There's not, okay, the book is published, it's out, we can then read reviews in the American Historical Review and so on, and then come to our conclusions about this work. What about work that's ongoing? And so one of the pieces of advice, and I guess I'll just end this comment in this way, it's to say that, you know, if you have work that's ongoing, maybe the best thing you can do as you're devising your project and then as you move through it is to try to think of it in stages or phases. Be iterative, and I think that has other advantages, of course. I think many DH people already know that often it's those iterative stages that sort of set the table for the next grant application, or whatever that next stage is. So you need to think in terms of being iterative to start out with, just inherently. But it also is a good way of helping your colleagues, you know, in your department or college, understand and grasp a little more what you're doing. Because if they can see these benchmarks along the way, maybe they can begin to see how they can measure those at different points while allowing that project to go on and not just to have it doesn't have to end. In fact, arguably, it shouldn't end.
Yeah.
One of the things I like about Cleveland Historical is we're still doing it after, 8 years or 9 years. That's harder than, in some ways, than just the process of starting it. So how do you sustain it?
Yeah. I mean, you're creating this this living archive, basically, that will continue taking stories. And well, we've been focusing on Cleveland in this section. But I do want to talk a little bit more about your work in Kisumu. And you mentioned that Kisumu was historically segregated. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that. And also, just, you know, you in your earlier remarks, talked about the student collaborations and a little bit more about any impact that may have arose from that. Like, are the students staying in touch, or did some of them travel there, you know, after graduating?
Sure. Starting with the segregation, and I think maybe we have the slide up here. I showed this in my presentation, of course, too. You can see the red zones that divided the city. I should also mention that the British in the various cities in not just Kenya, but throughout, of course, before it was Kenya, it was part of British East Africa, which also included Uganda. These cities were segregated in the sense that Africans were really largely kept to the periphery. They were not allowed to, for example, open formal businesses in the heart of the city or to establish living spaces at the very center. Now, there is what they call a native quarter here, but you can see that it's actually a minority of the area of the original Kisumu footprint. So, for starters, there is not outright exclusion, but there is a great restriction on where people can live and work, formally at least. And then there are rigid delineations with even these buffer zones of 1 to 2 blocks. And I think it's interesting if you look at the map that that I showed. It's from 1915, and the map shows that there's about what I would consider the equivalent of about 2 blocks of separation between the Europeans and the Indians. And there's about a 1 block separation between the Indians and the Africans. So there's even this hierarchy there where Asians are in the middle, really, sort of middle tier in terms of this colonial hierarchy. Now, moving to the part of your question about the impact of the project, yes, there are students who kept in touch after the semester ended, after their partnership ended. Some of them continue to text each other, keep up on WhatsApp, for example. In one case, one of our students at CSU, who was a graduate student in history, liked working on the project so much and you know, got close enough to his project partners over at Maseno that it inspired him not only to stay in touch with them, but he actually decided that he wanted to go into the Peace Corps, and he asked to be located in East Africa. And he actually was sent to Tanzania, but he was close enough that he was able to travel up to Kisumu, because Kisumu is not far from the Tanzanian border, I mean, relatively speaking. So that's pretty remarkable. I think that, you know, we're talking about really, on one level, encouraging global citizenship, greater empathy and awareness beyond our own culture, and people make friends, put simply.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of impact, both for the student but also for the institution, it's quite, you know, a remarkable story that can be told there. So we're nearing the end of this portion, and we want to make sure and leave time for Q&A. But I thought it would be helpful to take a step back just for a moment, because you alluded to this a little bit earlier about your perspective on the digital humanities, how it's evolved as a discipline, because you've been doing this kind of work for decades now, over a decade, and what you've seen evolve or change during that time.
Sure. I think one thing that has evolved to some extent is there's been much more written, and there's been much more thought about, you know, what is the digital humanities, or is they or are they? What is the digital humanities as a practice? You know, what does it look like? And what are the different, concerns that people have that they want to use it to address? In another way, I think it maybe has not changed so much. And I'll give you a different sense of this. It still has, in some ways, myriad definitions, just like public history in some ways. People still grapple with that, although maybe less so. There are different methodologies. People are working in different disciplines on this. And so if you're looking at computational literary studies, for example, there's a set of concerns in that branch of the of the field that may be different from someone like myself, who are more involved in the digital storytelling, oral history, the public history, digital history, with a public audience in mind. Some of the things that I think are interesting in terms of shifts that I've seen are, one involves the technology. For example, in the earlier days of digital humanities, you were more likely to see people building one-off platforms, for example, really, and often at great expense. They would get a big grant if they were lucky, and if so, they would build this great platform for their project, and then they wouldn't have any money really to sustain that, and that platform was so labor-intensive to maintain. That often it just sort of sat static and maybe degraded over time, until at some point they either had the money to move in a different direction to sustain it, or it lapsed. Now you're more likely to see people using extensible platforms like CurateScape, but many others, so that you are able to sort of leverage the open source development community, for one thing. And you're also sometimes able to take existing tools and either bend them or extend them a little bit, or maybe just to use them directly. Many projects do very well just taking a platform that already exists and using it to do what they want to do with it. So I think embrace of the extensible tools and tool sets is important. And I would add that a lot of projects have done a great job of collecting, digitizing materials, collecting them, and presenting them in a way that makes sense for their project and their adding interpretive value based on their own research interests, but they're also leaving something behind there too. So it's not just, you know, leaving something for others to use in terms of platforms. It's also leaving, in this case, something for other people to analyze. And I think of projects, for example, like mapping inequality that the University of Richmond Digital Scholarship Lab has done with redlining maps of the Homeowners Loan Corporation, or HOLC. They've basically put maps for cities all over the United States, large and small, in, and they've georectified them and made them interactive. And you can get to the actual appraiser's cards, or I don't know if they're called cards, but the appraiser's commentaries and grading of neighborhoods and not only just present those and do some interpretation with it, but you can let other scholars use that, and it can drive their scholarship as well. So I think that those are things that are exciting that maybe were not as present in the early parts of the movement, if you will.
It is interesting how the evolution that you're describing is seems to correlate with the evolution of some of these open source tools and communities. You know, they're kind of blossoming. So earlier we talked about the power of place-based history, and you said...
I think of place-based history as one that begins with the idea that the physicality of the place matters. It's a place not just where you can connect sensory experiences and, you know, in memories that attach to place, but it's also a place that people can value and that matters, that sometimes changes the trajectory of history, because things happen in a certain place in a certain way that may be different from other places, and we can compare those and analyze them.
That's it, Charlie. Perfect. Let's hear a clip. Well done.
I think it was the sauce, the amount of barbecue that they gave you, because we would get, I know it was shoulder sandwiches, and those things would be so thick with all that pork and that barbecue sauce in there. And at the time we ate white bread, and it would be so much barbecue sauce in there that the bread would be turning red because it was so much barbecue sauce in there. And then when you bit it, the shoulder would just fall out. It was so much in there. That's how thick and juicy it was. But everything, the French fries, you know, they would put the barbecue sauce on the French fries and hot sauce and all that. And everything was just so good. You know, we didn't know about our arteries and all that then. We just ate it.
That was Clara Nelson reminiscing about Scatter's Barbecue. And that was my favorite clip in those that you sent. And I'm vegetarian, and I'm really questioning my choices right now after hearing Miss Nelson. So this is the last question for this part of the podcast, but we'll transition to audience Q&A in just a moment. And I'd like to go back to this kind of word empathy, and what can projects like these teach us about building community across divides, whether they're social, economic, cultural? What insights might you share with students or educators or community members who want to do similar kinds of projects?
That's a great question. Thank you. Regarding bridging divides, I think sometimes one thing that we as scholars could do a better job of, and I'll include myself in this, I could do a better job at times of this, is don't just go to the community when you want something. Go to the community to listen to what they have to say. Go to an event. Go just to talk. First to listen, but then just to chat. And then if the opportunity presents itself, you can mention, if they say, well, what do you do at Cleveland State University? Say, oh, well, I do these projects. And, you know, interestingly, one of them is an oral history project. And maybe that's how you get someone interested in becoming involved. But you don't really get them interested by going out and saying, we want to do this project in your community, and here's, it's all laid out. But if you can come together and give them a sense that you're interested in, you know, what they could bring to the table, and giving them maybe a chance to help plan part of it, that is, that goes a long way. So that's one thing I would encourage people to do, is when they're thinking about bridging divides, think first about what you can learn from the community, and second about what you can deliver to the community. I think that's really important. Other things I would say is plan with goals in mind, specific goals. Are you encouraging social change? Are you trying to have a better informed citizenry? Are you trying to create a stronger sense of place? These are but a few ways that scholars, I think, can do a place-based project in the community. But you need to think about what are your goals. So I would encourage people to think carefully. And it could be multiple ones, of course. You could check the boxes, and it need not be one or the other. I think it's important, if you have multiple partners, to think about avoiding an unwieldy structure. Figure out who is going to represent the different constituencies and how are they going to work together. Who's going to plan what? When decisions need to be made, who's going to take responsibility to do this or that? Thinking also about not just collecting or curating or digitizing, but thinking about sharing the materials. Materials are not meant just to be collected and preserved, but they also need to be shared. And to what extent can you involve people outside the university in making some decisions? And it doesn't mean giving up complete control. It just means giving up exclusive control. And I think that's an important distinction to make. I mentioned before, be iterative. Don't think of, it's great to have like a blue sky idea, a really big idea. And sometimes you can't just make that happen. Maybe that big goal you have, that thing you're envisioning, could cost $300,000 or $500,000, and you can't imagine how you're going to get that money. But what if you started thinking instead about what are some small steps I can take to get there, and what are some deliverables, if you will, or some products that my colleagues can assess? And they don't, ideally, getting back to what I said before, ideally you don't just have to write a journal article to prove the worth of it. You need to be able to make some of those products born digital, and not just replications of traditional scholarship, but things that where the digital actually adds value that only it can add. And I guess I would say stick to open source platforms as much as possible. Try not to let the technology drive up the cost. Is there a way? It may not be the perfect way, but is it not better to do most of what you want to do at great cost savings, at least as a proof of concept? Maybe that's what gets your foot in the door for a grant to do exactly what you want to do. But thinking about, okay, I want to do this, and there's only one way to get there, that will be a sure recipe for doing nothing. And finally, I'd say social media. One of the things that I've thought about quite a lot is that I used to lament that, we'd get on Twitter and Facebook, and we would try to build our audience for Cleveland Historical, for example, or for Curating Kisumu. And you'd look and you'd get a few retweets, and it's very ephemeral, and it doesn't feel like you've really connected. And you start asking, you start looking at the analytics, and you which you can easily do, go to Google Analytics for your website, and you find out that, there's not that much traffic redirected from Twitter to Cleveland Historical. There's some, but not as much as would be ideal. So begs the question, should you be doing this? Should you be in those spaces? And my feeling is yes, you should, because you can actually present different faces of a project. And so I've started to think about our different social media channels for the different projects as other faces of the project. And maybe people don't click through. That makes it more incumbent upon me. For example, if we use Instagram, we have more room to say something in a longer form. Facebook, same way. Twitter, 280 characters, right, and you're out. But what can we do to curate our content in these different spaces?
Yeah. Well, this brings us to the end of the interview portion, and there where you go. There's your Twitter handle and Facebook information. But we've intentionally left some time for audience voices. Just to clarify, we're recording, so if you want to ask a question but you don't want it on the podcast, come see me afterwards, and we will edit it out. So Todd has got a handheld mic that he will go to you. He'll come to you if you have any questions. So go ahead and raise your hand. There's one right up here, the front. It's on.
Hello, my name is Eric Corbett. I'm a fifth-year PhD candidate here in digital media. This was a really interesting talk, and you know, the idea of the public history sort of reminds me of some of the same questions that, like, within the area of human-computer interaction, how we have this design process called participatory design, where you try to, you know, when you're trying to design technology, you bring people into the process of designing it with them instead of for them. Throughout that process, you can imagine there are all types of, like, power conflicts and, you know, things that go awry when you try to do that. And so I was taken with that one, the one term you used earlier, the sage on the stage thing, right? So to me, I'm wondering, and there's probably, I'm obviously not in this area, I'm coming completely from outside, so I haven't read anything on that, I don't know, I'm making assumptions about what it might mean, but to me, it sort of signifies that there is this existing sort of practice of history, and there's sort of this power embedded in this position, right? And then, but at the same time, if you're trying to do the public history, you might be coming into conflict with that. So were there any sort of conflicts around, I guess, like, existing practices of history, especially in that situation, and just more broadly, the you know, what type of conflicts might occur when you're trying to do this type of work?
That's a great question. I could answer it in, I guess, a number of different ways. I'm going to pick one, I guess, and we'll see how, if this resonates. One way I could answer that is to think back to several years ago when we were working in a particular neighborhood, and this was for the Cleveland Historical Project. And in this particular neighborhood, we had some community volunteers who were working in a, you know, with us to curate stories. And we were actually, our role in this was to facilitate them and to facilitate their writing rather than, you know, using them as informants, for example, to write stories ourselves. And so in one case, a woman who was involved as a community writer but was very attached to her particular construction of the history of this particular neighborhood. And so she, you know, she presented her draft, and we, of course, were then going to look at the drafts and talk about them and, you know, together, and then look at, you know, what different ways you might take that and sort of massage it in one direction or another and to make it maybe more broadly resonant. And one of the things that it pointed out, I think in some ways the differences in how people come at history sometimes was that she was really, really interested. She felt very, very much like it was important to tell every detail of how this the community changed. It was a part of Cleveland that had, part of it had been annexed into the city, and part of it had gone from being unincorporated to being a village to then going through this series of transitions, and part of it was a separate suburb, and then part of it was another suburb. And so she was really trying to tell every part of that, and she felt it was very important because she was very knowledgeable about it, and she wanted to convey that. And but what was missing in this particular story was a sense of what, you know, annexation. Why is annexation important in cities? And what are the dynamics of the question of annexation as cities expand and larger cities begin to engulf villages, for example? And so in this particular case, it was unfortunate because we were not on the same page. She did not want to change her story at all. And so what do you do? Ultimately, in this case, we didn't come to, mutually agreeable terms. And she said, if I can't publish it exactly like this, I don't want to publish it at all. And I thought to myself, well, this in some ways, it shows, you know, the scholar wants to bring certain value to this as a scholar while allowing the public's voice to come through and making that central. And I feel like I wish we had been able to find that common ground, and usually we do. That's why I see this one more clearly, the failure, because it stands out. It's sort of unusual, but it does happen where you're not on the same page at all. And I think in some ways, as scholars, we're used to dealing with this in the form of peer review, and we have to develop a sense of give and take. And sometimes a peer reviewer wants me to do something that I don't feel comfortable doing, and I may be able to push back a little bit, but I also have to show that I've thought about what they've done, and I have to come to some compromise. We usually find a way to meet them somewhere. If not in the middle, we meet somewhere away from where we started. And I think that's one of the real challenges. And you mentioned participatory design. In some ways, thinking back, maybe what we needed to do was to spend more time talking about what each side was going to contribute and how could we find a way to have common ground and allow everyone to feel like they had a stake in the project. Maybe we could do more.
So my question is, do you think that digital humanities are suited for subdisciplines in history, like across the board, or you think that they're particularly well suited for specific subdisciplines? I'm thinking, is it as well suited for urban histories as it is for labor history or environmental history? So,
I think it's well suited for any kind of history. As an urbanist, I think that, well, spatially, urban history is a very spatial topic. Place and space really are very important, and so it's especially relevant, maybe. But I don't think it matters, because if we're thinking about projects that aren't necessarily, for example, map-based, just as one example, I think we can think of any body of primary sources is suitable for being either analyzed or presented in an accessible way, or both. I don't think it matters what the subject is. So I think really any subdiscipline is fair game. You need to have rich primary sources, I think, to work with. And what you do with those, it varies widely, but I think there's something for everyone, potentially.
Hi, Mark. I'm Steve Usselman. I'm a historian here. I'm really curious about the mechanics of the process. So if you could march us through the steps of how you get one of the barbecue interviews from conceptualization to up there and accessible.
Okay, let's take the barbecue one, the Scatters barbecue story, and use that as my case in point. That was done a few years ago. I had a student who was an intern, not a standard intern. It was not an intern in the sense of working out in the community for an organization. It was an intern-like situation in which she was in the Honors College at CSU, and she had particular interests that included, she had some radio background at the campus radio station. She was not a history major, but she was interested in developing interviewing as a technique. And the Honors College told her that maybe she could get 3 credit hours by doing a guided project in the center under my direction. And I agreed to do it. And we called it an internship, but it was really sort of a like an independent study. And so we devised a project in which she was interested in the Glenville neighborhood, where Scatters is. And so we started with a plan to have her read as much scholarly material as we could that would contextualize that neighborhood in Cleveland's history and nationally. From there, we thought about how could we find connections you know, to the community. And so we worked with a community organization in Glenville, as well as with the public library branch, to find a small, manageable number of people for her to interview within the confines of a semester. So she ended up interviewing 8. We're starting with a larger list, but of course, with oral history, it doesn't always work out. Some people don't come through for various reasons. So she interviewed 8 people, and she started out, I told her not to have any preconceived notions about really what she was going to do with this yet, that we knew we were going to do 2 Cleveland historical stories. But what those were, I had no preconceived notions. I said, anything is fair game. You're going to go through the interviewing process and you're going to modify how you interview as you go. You're going to learn to be a better interviewer, but you're also going to modulate sort of what sets of questions you ask based on what you learn in earlier interviews. So she started to find that, again, this is a place-based project, so what were those 2 places going to be? We started out thinking about known landmarks, but I said, you're probably going to find that there's some surprise along the way. And it turns out there were several. One of them was Scatter's Barbecue, and she never set out to ask people questions about Scatter's. She didn't even know about it, nor did I. Nor did she set out to write a Cleveland historical story. But what happened was, through the process of interviewing, people kept mentioning Scatter's. And so she started asking questions about Scatter's. And that, the more she asked about it, the more people elaborated on it. And so by the time you got to people like Clara Nelson and also, I think it's Leo Martin. I may have to double check the name. I believe it was Leo Martin did the one about the murder of Stevens. By then we knew we had the nuts and bolts of a good story, but then she had to do archival research and mostly newspaper in this case, to really flesh out a story. So that's really what we did. When I'm doing it in a class, I actually think first about doing a research paper that has different stages, from building a bibliography to collecting some primary sources to doing some short writing and then expanding into a full research paper. All that happens in the first 12 weeks of my course. And then in weeks 13 to 15, we close it out by talking about bending that toward a public audience. And that's the space in which they're curating their Cleveland historical story. And in that case, they're only doing one story based on a research paper of, say, 12 pages for undergrads, or maybe about 16 pages for graduate students. So that maybe gives you a bit of an idea of what we're doing.
So unfortunately, we are out of time, because this is a beautiful reading room that is will be used for reading in just a few short minutes. But remember, a carefully crafted version of this podcast will be available as a special episode via lostinthestacks.org. Or you can sign up with your email right over there. There's a piece of paper, and we'll make sure to send you the link. Mobilizing History with Professor J. Mark Souther was a collaboration between the Georgia Tech Library and the School of History and Sociology, written and produced by Amit Doshi, Charlie Bennett, Todd Mishney, and Mark Souther. Charlie was our AV engineer today, and this presentation would not have been possible without the support and enthusiasm of Todd, the History and Sociology School, and of the library administration, and all of you fine folks for attending. You can find us online at lostinthestacks.org, and you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and plenty of other places that we don't even know about. So let's give a final round of applause to Professor Souther. Thank you all for participating today, and stay tuned for more public programs from Georgia Tech Library coming this fall.
Thanks for listening to this special presentation by Lost in the Stacks. You can find the whole presentation, including J. Mark Souther's original remarks, at hdl.handle.net/1853/60984. Or you can search for Mobilizing History, Reflections on a Decade of Digital Humanities Practice on 2 Continents at the Digital Repository for the Library. smarttech.gotech.edu, SMARTECH. All right. We'll talk to you in the new year. Hope everybody's doing well.